The Wire.
I then talked to Forrest Kapo and Jess Holly Bates, the co-creators of their live art show Inheritance. Their show hopes to provoke discussions and critique capitalism, the intersection of race and class, and the differences in what Māori and Tauiwi have inherited. I begin by asking Forrest what the show is about, and you'll hear Jess respond throughout.
The show is called Inheritance, and it's based on wealth inequality in New Zealand, Aotearoa, with some focus primarily around Ruth Richardson's Other All Budgets 1991 fiasco. There was quite a big shift moving from more equal kind of fair distribution of resources to something that now we've named neoliberalism. It was a big betrayal at that time.
Well, I think Ruth was in the national government, right?
Yeah.
That's the change, yeah.
So Rogernomics was probably the first, yeah. And then Ruth Richard built on top of that.
What was the thing that happened with Ruth Richard?
Oh, yeah, so the 1991 Mother of All Budget, which is fascinating because it happened when I was six. And so for me, like, all of the things that came from that budget just feel like normal, like that's just the water we're swimming in. But actually, that was when university fees came in. They rose by 1,000%, and benefits were slashed by 47%, which is astronomical. That's like half of what people have coming into their households taken away in one day, and they have never been increased meaningfully since that moment. So, I mean, I think the families, there was like a families package that came out under Helen Clark's government, are working for families, and that just increased it really minimally, but only for the middle classes. So right at the bottom, nothing has changed since 1991, which is really quite extraordinary and shocking. And for some reason, we think that's not related to child poverty, to mass Māori imprisonment, to domestic violence issues. You know, really the stress that gets caused right at the bottom is deeply related to this moment in 1991. And of course, before that, there's even more, right? We've got a couple of hundred years of pretty difficult history here. But the pressure cooker really came on, I reckon, in that year.
Well, I was around at that time. So 1991 for me was, there was a cut in my welfare. I was on the unemployment at the time. It's also encapsulated with a lot of other things that were going on at the time. So in 1987-85, which is the Rogernomics kind of era, the big issues were freezing works, rural towns got made. Well, they were gutted, really, in all senses of the word. So towns like Paetia, Tamaranui, those really small, Napier, Hastings, which is where I was at the time when that happened, really got left with reeling, like economically. Like people just packed up in droves and moved to places like Auckland and Australia. It was definitely one of the places to go to recover from being made redundant, and a huge, huge drove. So it really just shifted the whole experience of living in a small town to something else. And then on top of that era or those policies, along came Ruth Richardson, and she sort of just kind of like cemented that kind of class division with her policies, inflicting more pain in a lot of ways that really began to separate and create class and wealth divisions. So they're interesting years politically for New Zealand, because I think the outcome we're beginning to see now really clearly.
And that, to me, like the fundamental, the belief of the underneath that policy decision, right, is that poverty is good for you. Like, suffering is good for you. Like, it'll make you strive further. It'll make you work harder. You know, you won't go to the doctor unless you really need to. All of those, like, that real belief that if you make things harder for people, then they work to get out of them. But that's just not true.
I think at the time, what was so interesting is that no one really understood what would happen by introducing things like student loans and decreasing welfare payments. No one really understood really where the impacts would land. And so now we've got generations where we're really beginning to see what those impacts are and who they're really impacting on. And that becomes something that we can now document and research, and we've got those numbers and statistics now. I think that's what's so interesting about where we are. But I think my feeling is that there was some fairly strong narcissistic pushes towards wanting to improve own reservoir financial wealth. And really the only way that you could do that would be to implement these kind of policies where free markets reigned. We're really using the word free market because, as we now know, that this particular type of economic viewpoint really doesn't have any basis. It really is a closed loop. It doesn't grow anything outside of it.
What does the free market look like nowadays?
It looks like climate change.
I personally don't understand a lot about economics, so I'm just hoping to understand what is the free market. Like, what does that mean for the average person?
That means that at the time, state-owned enterprises were sold off, and so free market means that education becomes a competitive environment. Universities have to compete funding, and they have to charge their students massive amounts, so it becomes more about making a profit than it does about actually meeting the need of the people it's supposed to serve. Same with the healthcare system. So
yeah, that's right. It means deregulation, those kind of experiences like education and health. So profit versus quality is monetizing incrementally everything.
I think at a base level, like, capitalism really lives in our bodies because we really do believe that we have to work harder and that we're not enough all the time, and that we have to work harder, get more and be more all of the time in order to be okay. We have to acquire more objects. And so it's never okay under capitalism to sit down and relax. It's never okay to be resting, really. And I think that actually that viewpoint is what we've inherited. So as well, we've got harder as a country in terms of looking at each other, and that we've got more disconnected from each other as a result of that of those free market policies.
What it also has done is it's degraded and or probably graded human rights, what that really looks like. So, I mean, how comfortable are you? How much are you willing to pay for that comfort? How much do you want to be educated? How much are you willing to pay for that education? So really breaking it down to like incremental fundamental rights having a cost and a benefit. And so the people who have the benefits are the people who, and privileges are the people who have financial ability.
Yeah, I think it gets pretty interesting when you think about like what we used to have in this country, which was cradle to grave welfare. Like, that just blows my mind, this idea that the state is actually responsible for people's welfare and that it should take care of you if you do not have enough at any stage in your life. And that idea is only mind-blowing because I was born under neoliberal reforms, which now seem like the air we breathe. But for you it's different, eh? Your eyes shrink when I say that, so I'm like, what's been going on for you?
Well, it's different because like some of the cradle to grave policies were born out of the Second World War and Depression, and so there was a real need to actually create an environment where people could rebuild. And so in one point after the Second World War, in many countries around the world, rebuilding is what we did. And so there was a necessity for the government to actually take responsibility for where they had landed people. I mean, that's kind of a really weird kind of way of putting it. But so when we begin to introduce things like free market, free policies, what we begin to do is we begin to say, like in a funny way, oh, you're now individuals, you are now able to like go forth and make choices based around your understanding of what you can and can't do. And it seems really like if I was a parent, that's what I would want to do to any child, is help them have the autonomy to make decisions, etc., etc. In New Zealand, though, the shift from helping people to be less community-minded to be, I guess, more individuals, it actually didn't come with a lot of support and it didn't come with a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. And so the people who weren't able to, I guess, manifest the same kind of support or access to resources really didn't prosper, and then there was no responsibility for that, and there really needed to be, especially around 1985, 1987 kind of crashes that were happening in the world at that time.
What's the dialogue that needs to happen moving forward?
Yeah, we talked a lot about that today in rehearsal, what the dialogues were and how to be accountable for what we have inherited. And in this piece it's really difficult because in some ways we do represent, I guess, different sides or different spaces of that conversation.
I think what we've inherited is really different from one another in our bodies, in our bank accounts, you know, spiritually. Also our responsibilities are different, our cultural responsibilities are different. And so it's really interesting. It's a really interesting process making this show and trying to figure out what you do once you know all of this, like what now? And I think that dialogue is really tender but really necessary, hey? So the show is really a response to the what now, like how can we hold the space of this conversation but actually be here.
So we're talking about things like maybe calling time out on a competitive game of colonisation, perhaps recognising what we actually have inherited on an intrinsic level, whether that be financially got handed down, what you have, what level you've educated yourself to, those kind of privileges that make a big difference to your opportunities that you have in your life.
And I have to say, like, we called it really early on a sitcom. And we were just talking today about, yeah, it actually is like a bit of a sitcom, like one's from Waikato, one's from Auckland. Like it feels a bit like that because it's so ridiculous to be sitting here with growing up in the same country with just such radically different experiences and different opportunities available to you and different reservoirs of wealth and joy and belonging. It's almost absurd. And I think that's as well what we are trying to tune into in this conversation is, yeah, there's something really serious here we need to address, but also, like, let's look at how absurd it is that we live in the same country and we have such different experiences. Mm-hmm. There's a healing as well, I think, in that laughter, eh?
Yeah, it is, it's a really difficult conversation. It's a beast of a topic.
What did we do, eh?
And it really feels like at times like I don't want to be in the room even though I'm making the piece. But it also feels like I have to be responsible or been asked to be responsible to name experiences that I've inherently grown up with. And then at the same time, my competitor or my colleague or my creative is representing or has a body that is representational of all that I sometimes... want.
Really?
No.
She wants to say white supremacy, but like doesn't want to say it. Just put it out. Yeah. At some point, we do become these representational figurines of our class upbringings, you know. And so
the questions have become: how do we actually create a piece that actually talks and asks these really, really hard questions? And how do we get to the end of the piece and still be friends? I think if myself and Jess can have this conversation and we can really kind of sit and listen and open up spaces where we can really name the things that have caused us, I guess, trauma in my case, and we can discuss the inequalities that have existed that are structural and systemic and political decisions that have really impacted and influenced my ability to be public and contribute in a way that's meaningful, that it can really honour my potential, then feel like in some ways we're doing it on behalf of our communities.
I think, and the conversation's going to happen in the room too with the people that are there, right? Because, I mean, I think we are offering a space of hope by staying in the room and having the conversation. And actually, to me, the tuning in that needs to happen.
Yeah.
Not getting up and going to the toilet, like actually just staying there. True though, like going to the toilet is such a good...
Does it happen? I used to do that when my mum told me, like, wash the dishes, and I'd be like, I can't.
I've got to go to the toilet. Yeah.
Do people do that in a show?
Well, not, yeah, sometimes in a show, when things get too uncomfortable, like, you know, I've actually just got to... I respect it as a safety thing, but I also think we have to stay in the room. Mm.
I wanted to ask specifically, your play is talking about class division and the intersection with race.
Yes.
So is class and race inherently linked?
In this country, yes, very much so. So we've got lots of statistics that may or not show up in the actual piece, but yes, unfortunately, yes, they are very strongly linked.
That's kind of global, isn't it? The global south. I mean, there's definitely a pattern across the globe.
Yeah, that's true.
Of people of colour having less means. And so, yeah, class is such a misty experience, though. You know, it's so interesting. It's like in what you bring to the potluck. Like, it's really hard to put your finger on what class is until you're like, oh, we're not speaking the same language, but we are. But yeah.
What does class look like in New Zealand? Do you think people are aware of it? Is the public perception generally aware of class?
We don't talk about it. I don't think it's a very sexy term anymore. Nobody talks about class anymore. Talk about socioeconomic difference. We can say the word poverty.
I think there was a time once in New Zealand where we were like sort of, we had the opportunities to be classless. There was a real breakaway from the English class system that colonialists or the settlers had. But there was also at that time a real push to create a different kind of system. And so there was a lot of New Zealand history where being classless was
That's such a myth, though. Like, come on.
It is a myth now.
No, but absolutely. That wasn't even a myth at the time. Like, yeah. It's like, yeah, that's true of the white dudes that were here. But let's be honest. There were Chinese people here right from the get-go, and they didn't get to vote for, like, hundreds of years. And Māori people didn't get a shoe into this egalitarian paradise. And women as well. Like, women were not really around either. So, I mean, it's just like... classless to who?
That's true.
Do you think being aware of these class divisions will stop people being
racist?
Oh,
no, that's a really good question. I like that question a lot. Look, I came from an artistic class. The people that will come to the show are sort of, I assume, in some ways are already interested in supporting us as individuals and also as a collective. So I think the... like on a really hopeful day, the best that I can hope for is that we begin to really just learn how to listen to ourselves. Change is slow, right?
Interesting, eh? I think our work is, I'm not interested in making a work where I have to argue that racism exists or that inequality exists or that child poverty is devastating rates in New Zealand.
Yeah, child poverty, mental health.
Suicide rates. So that's where we start from. And now we move on. And I think if we don't make spaces to have more complicated conversations than constantly proving that it's okay to have brown skin and exist, you know, it's okay to be transgender, it's okay, you know, like, if we have to keep going back there and being like, actually, some people do have more than others, some people do have less opportunities than others, if we have to start the conversation all the way back there, we're never going to be able to have a more interesting, more hopeful conversation, which is, I think, what we want to tune into.
I don't think our show in itself is going to stop racism, but it's going to be a key part. Mm. It definitely is going to offer some space to have some of those conversations and to actually see us try and figure out what those conversations are, see us trying to figure out where we could go, see us trying to actually establish different ways that we can relate to systemic political decisions that have created these class inequalities. I think that's the main key for me, is that we are just beginning to start this conversation, which is a conversation that I think we all eventually will have to have within ourselves and in our homes, with our friends, with our families, with our parents. Mm. The show in itself, no, of course not. But it's definitely a part of a big conversation that hopefully will just help other people begin to have those conversations.
What I would say in relation to that is, like, I don't see racists as other people over there. Everybody has prejudice living inside them, myself included, no matter how much work I've done. Forest included, no matter how much work you've done. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, I think the conversation starts with yourself, and I'm interested in making art that revolutionizes myself, and in doing so, empowers other people to do the same. And staying in the room and making this work, that is challenging, and that is overturning things and me that I did not know existed, because we don't talk about class.
How do we talk about class in a way that's productive?
Oh, well, we began to have that. That was one of our first questions, wasn't it? Like, how do we actually talk about wealth? And so we did this really simple but really quite telling exercise where we named our net worth and our liabilities. And it's an interesting conversation because often people don't talk about what their worth is monetarily or monetary. And so it began by naming what our net worth is. What my personal wealth is, and it was really discomforting. And the answers to that exercise really resonated in me, and in so many ways. It took me probably a good 3 to 4 weeks to really kind of figure out how to hold the information, but just to help us with how we can begin to have a conversation about classism. It would start by beginning to talk about what your net worth is and what your family's net worth is and what you really have inherited. So, for example, just to be transparent, I earn $60,000 a year. I have a mortgage that is $186,000, which is actually a liability. I have superannuation of $100,000 in my super fund in Australia. I also have student loan still that actually is $28,000, and actually because of the interest rates actually went up to $60,000 at one point. So for an education that actually costed at the time $23,000, I would have paid that three times over. And it also has an interest rate that is higher than my mortgage rate in Australia. So go figure that, boy.
Yeah, like I'm going to inherit my parents' rental property in Mount Eden. Like when you actually say that out loud, you're like, oh, I've got this massive cloak of safety that follows me everywhere. That means like I can turn away from something and be like, you know what, I think I might just become an artist. Because I know on some bone level that I'm going to be okay. Like I can't afford property in this city, but I'm also not trying to chase it.
Because I wanted to ask on that whole thing with class and being creative, because recently I think we've seen that spin-off article that said creatives earn an average of 15K.
Oh,
So that's been going around. And so I've always been wondering, is the ability to create art and be creative and be an artist, is that a privilege?
Okay, look, so I came from an incredibly impoverished working class family, and so being an artist was never something that existed in my parents' dream for me in any real shape or form. So my access to any arts in any shape or form, visual, physical performance, was really opportunistic. So my relationship to myself being an artist was a really slow growing, developing kind of like awareness that actually in some ways for me to exist as a human being in this world and feel okay about what I was doing in this world, actually making art is something that I had to do. But it has taken me this amount, like when I'm holding up my fingers, like a trout size, large trout by the by, amount of time to kind of really understand that my contribution could be on an artistic level and it didn't need to be on a more academic level. But given the funding bodies and the way that they hold arts value in New Zealand, it's really, really difficult to consistently make money from that contribution to our communities.
Like, my family wasn't particularly keen on me being an artist either. I've got like 8 backup plans I got at this university that we're sitting in. But what they didn't realise, what they didn't bank on, my lovely parents, what they didn't bank on is that the amount of confidence and self-worth and joy and belonging they poured into me from a young age, which is correlated to the amount of money they earn, gave me a sense that I had a right to have a voice and have things to say, and that other people would be interested in hearing those things. And so they set me up, much to their great chagrin, they set me up to become an artist in many ways. And so I think, yes, there is privilege associated with being an artist if I look at my story, because I go, actually, it's the emotional bedrock you stand on that gives you the sense of right to be a citizen and an artist at the same time.
Yeah, it sounds like both of you have different views, something that we'll probably see in the play, I guess, that's two people with very different views and
different views, different backgrounds, different ways of problem solving. Mm. I mean, I think we need to have these conversations because the biggest threat we are facing as people is climate change, and we aren't going to be able to like come together and recognise the essence of life, which is maintaining ourselves in a really healthy and holistic way.
Would you say climate change is caused by capitalism?
Yeah, totally. I the correlation seems pretty strong to me. We've had free markets that have been really irresponsible. Their closed loop economic policies that have just used resources as if they were infinite. And they're not infinite, and we do have to pay a price, and actually we are going to have to pay a price. Who pays that price is actually part of our exploration, because actually it's really clear who's going to pay the price. It's going to be the minorities, the people who are less able to shift their safety parameters, whether that's via land, et cetera, et cetera.
Else you two wanted to add for Rapt?
Yeah, I think I would just say that that inheritance is an invitation, yeah, an invitation to look at what you got and what you didn't get, and to take a moment to count.
Throughout the interview, it did raise a lot of questions for me that I didn't feel quite equipped to ask due to my lack of knowledge on economics, but I'm wondering what realistic alternatives there are other than capitalism. I don't know, there's a lot of questions.
You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.